Welcome to Recovery Comes Home Radio, your go-to podcast for all things related to addiction recovery. Whether you are an individual in recovery, a concerned loved one, or a dedicated professional, this podcast is tailored just for you. Here, we are all about empowering you with the tools, insights, and inspiration you need to move forward. So grab your headphones, tune in, and let's embark on this transformative journey together.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening to another podcast of Recovery Comes Home Radio. Today, our guest is Richard Capriola. He is the author of a new book for parents entitled The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse. He has 2 decades in mental health and addictions as a counselor for one of the nation's top 10 psychiatric hospitals. I am so pleased to be able to bring Richard on today. I know that he's going to add a lot of value to all of our listeners. And just welcome to the podcast, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to spend some time with you and with your audience. It's an honor to be here. And I look forward to our discussion. So thank you so much for inviting me to the program.
You're certainly welcome. You definitely have some experience, I think, that our listeners and especially the families of those who are addicted or in recovery can really benefit from. So I'm super excited about our conversation today.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So why don't you get us started by telling a little bit about how you got into this field?
I started in education as a state-level school administrator. And as I transitioned out of that career, which lasted about 3 decades, I started to work at a mental health crisis center and was doing counseling for people who would come to the crisis center from the emergency rooms. And I noticed that they had not only a mental health crisis that they were struggling with, but also a substance use issue. So I went back to the University of Illinois and obtained more education and a degree in substance abuse counseling. Continued to work at the crisis center for a while until I was offered a position at Menninger Clinic in Houston, Texas. Menninger, as you noted, is one of the top 10 psychiatric hospitals in the country. It serves both adolescents and adults diagnosed with psychiatric disorders and substance abuse disorders. I worked on the adolescent unit and the adult psychiatric comprehensive and stabilization unit. And so many times I would sit across from a family and I would go through their child's history of using a substance. And when I finished, they sometimes would look across at me and they would say, I had no idea this was going on. Or if they did suspect their child was using a substance, they might say, well, I sort of knew something was going on, but I didn't know it was this bad.
But I didn't know what. Yeah.
And these are good families. These are very good families doing the best they can. They miss the warning signs because nobody told them what to look for. So when I left Menninger, I wanted to write my book, The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse. I kept it to about 100 pages because parents and families are busy. They don't have time to read volumes of information. But I wanted to pack it with as much information as I could so that families would be able to read this resource quickly and walk away with a feeling that I've got this. I understand it a little bit better. I hope I don't have to deal with this issue, but if I do, I feel better prepared to deal with it. And I wanted to give families the warning signs of what to look for. It's like anything else. If we know what to look for, we're more likely to catch it early on and intervene. And that's what I wanted to help families with.
And what was your experience with the families you were encountering? Had they had a lot of education around addiction? Was this something that was clearly out of left field? What was your experience with that?
They had been struggling with a teenager who is using substances. And many times they had been struggling for long periods of time. And the entire family had become disrupted because of this child using a substance or drinking alcohol and the behaviors that are associated with that child's use. So the entire family system was affected by this child's use. And many times it became very traumatic for the family And they came to Menninger Clinic, quite honestly, because they had gotten to the point where it had become a crisis, an emergency, and they had to hospitalize their child. Well, as you know, oftentimes we put the focus on the child because the child's the one who has the addiction, and the family gets neglected. And it's the family that oftentimes needs support as well. So I recommend to families that if you're going through this crisis with your child who's using a substance, you need to build a support system around yourself because you're going to need it. This is going to be a journey. This is going to take some time. As you go with your child through the treatment and recovery process, you're going to need a good support system around you, some people that you can talk to, some people that relate to what you're going through so that you don't feel so alone in this journey, which can be a very frightening and lonely journey for too many people.
Now, have you found that there are support groups for parents?
Yes. Like anything else, it depends where you live. In many of the large urban areas, there are mental health associations that offer support groups. Sometimes you can find these through church organizations, faith-based organizations. Sometimes we'll offer support groups. And sometimes it can be just as simple as having family and friends that can be your support system. Regardless of the route that you go, whether it's through a formal mental health association like NAMI, for example, or you go through your local church, or you go through the school district, whatever it is, or maybe it's just a group of family and friends that you have, that you hold close to you, that you feel comfortable talking to. Whatever it is, it's important that you have those friendships and those, develop those relationships with people that can be your support system.
Absolutely. We often say that's the third step in our ABCs of recovery is create a stellar support system.
Yes.
Starting with a higher power. The first one is accept your situation and prioritize action. Then be brave enough to start over and over until you get it right and create a stellar support system, because nobody, I don't believe, was meant to do this life by themselves.
Yeah.
And isolation is a killer no matter what the issue is.
Isolation is. It breeds loneliness. It breeds depression and anxiety. And this is a very stressful situation under the best of conditions. So the more that you can build a support system, and it doesn't have to be a large support system, just a support system.
I've found with our parents, it's not like they can go with most of their girlfriends and have a manicure, pedicure, and talk about my son's back on crack again.
Yeah. It needs to be a support group that has experience dealing with what you're dealing with, you know, and that's why oftentimes if you work through organizations like NAMI or you work through other substance abuse support groups, you can find people that have gone down this journey or are going on this journey right now that you will feel comfortable to, because you feel that you have something in common with them, that they will understand what you're going through, because chances are they either have or are going through the same thing you're going through. Absolutely.
And understanding where few others can, unless they've been in the situation themselves.
Yeah, I mean, they can empathize with you, but unless you've actually gone down this road, you truly have no idea of the emotions involved and the intensity, the ups and downs and the swings and emotions. And people who are going through this journey or have gone through this journey are more likely to relate to how you're feeling. And it's important that you find people who can relate to how you're feeling. Not just what you're saying, but what you're feeling.
Right. I agree. How do you think families can prepare? Like if their child needs to go to some type of detoxification or treatment, what are some tips you can give our listeners that the families can do while their loved one is getting treatment so that they're better prepared themselves for when their loved one eventually comes home?
Yeah, I think the first thing that we know is that treatment works. Yeah. So there has to be a sense of hope. We know that treatment works. And every child is different. Every treatment plan is different. Some children will do well in an outpatient setting. Some kids will do very well in an intensive outpatient setting. And then there are some kids whose substance abuse is so severe and the mental health issues are so severe that they can do very well in a residential program where they might be in treatment for months.
Right.
And during that journey, that's when parents are going to need a lot of support. As the child gets closer to discharge, then the parent needs to participate in an aftercare program, a relapse prevention program, because that child will be coming back into the home environment. And that's why it's so important that during treatment, the family is involved in family therapy sessions to help the family restructure that environment that the child will be coming back into so that it is a supportive, encouraging environment that will enable that child to have a better opportunity at maintaining their recovery.
Right. I couldn't agree more. That's so essential. Do you think that there is an issue with, we've seen in our parents that, and our children aren't, I call them our children, they're anywhere from 18 to our oldest resident was 81.
Okay.
So they're not children, all of them, but many of them are. The average age coming out of treatment is 24. But we find that it's particularly difficult for them to reintegrate into the family and the family knowing what to do with the sober member of their family now.
Yeah.
You know, they've been in one of these situations for so long. What do you think are some steps that families can take to work towards that reintegration and rebuilding that trust?
Well, I think that gets back to family therapy. I think during the treatment and recovery process, it's important that families take advantage of opportunities that are there for family therapy, where you can address the issue of what is life going to be like when this person returns to the family system, regardless of whether they're living with the family or not. Many of these adults may not actually be returning to the family itself, but nevertheless, it's going to be interacting with the family. So I think it's important that the family participate in family therapy that will help them restructure how they're going to be in a relationship with this recovering individual, because as you noticed, things are going to be different and they need to recognize that things are different now, and that requires a change in their behaviors as well, you know, so that they are creating and participating a supportive environment. Things are different. And that was the whole purpose of treatment, to make things different.
Yes.
And now the environment is different. So they may need some help in how to restructure their environment, how to restructure how they're going to have a relationship with this recovering person. What is their role in supporting the recovery? So there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed before the person returns back to society.
And boundaries, I would imagine.
Definitely boundaries, because many times families have sort of allowed those boundaries to erode, and now they have to be rebuilt and maintained, and families need help in how to do that.
Now, do you notice the same thing that we're noticing in the last 5 years? There's been this switch where I would say 5 years ago, we mostly got primary addiction, secondary mental health. But now we're seeing primary mental health way more, secondary addiction.
Yes, I think we have a mental health crisis in this country that has been ignored for a long period of time. We've known for over 10 years that we have a mental health crisis among the adolescent population. Among the adolescent population. Sadly, what I've noticed is that in too many cases, we are quick to diagnose the substance use disorder because it's so obvious. And we miss the underlying mental health disorder that's there. So the focus gets on the substance use. And so many times the individual who is struggling with a mental health disorder, that gets undiagnosed and untreated. We identify and we treat the substance use disorder, but we miss the underlying mental health disorder that doesn't get diagnosed and treated. And that is a formula for relapse.
Absolutely.
Because many times, as you well know, the person is using a substance to medicate that underlying mental health issue. An example that I can give you is that many of the teenagers that I worked with at Menninger Clinic were smoking a lot of marijuana. They were smoking every day. Multiple times a day in some cases. And when I asked them to help me understand why they were smoking so much marijuana, the number one answer that came back was, it helps me with my anxiety. So in many cases, the substance abuse person is using, not always, but in some cases, many cases, I think, too many cases, the person is using that substance to medicate an underlying mental health issue that unfortunately gets undiagnosed and untreated. And that's setting that person up for a relapse.
We're seeing that in spades now. So we've had to shift our focus and our business model a lot, quite actually, because it's just a whole nother animal when you're talking about co-occurring mental issues, and then compounded by the fact that they did try to self-soothe or self-medicate using substances. And interestingly enough, marijuana and alcohol are the two that I hear most often that they were trying to calm down the feelings.
Yes. Yeah, because, you know, nobody likes having these uncomfortable feelings or thoughts or memories. And teenagers don't either. And that's why we see in many cases, too many cases, a teenager is turning to a substance to medicate an underlying issue like anxiety or depression or trauma or bullying. And it's unfortunate that for both adults and adolescents, in too many cases, we miss that underlying issue. And that person is left to struggle with those issues. And sadly, many times they return to using a substance because the underlying issue hasn't been dealt with and resolved.
Yes. And we certainly as a world have gone through a crisis that had been never seen before.
Yeah.
A worldwide crisis overnight. And people all handled that in various ways. One of the things that we saw an uptick in was professionals and executives. We're talking C-suite, CEO level, that their board of directors had to say, you've been drinking too much during COVID. You can't come back to work. So you go to detox.
It's interesting because Menninger Clinic has a unit that is devoted to so-called professionals. It was at one time called Professionals in Crisis, and it did provide mental health and substance abuse services to the exact population that you just mentioned. And then, as you mentioned, the pandemic came along, and that just disrupted everything. Interestingly enough, during the pandemic, teen substance abuse took a nosedive and went substantially down. It started Yes, it went down quite a bit across the board, but we now have data a year after the pandemic, and what we're seeing is it started to rebound. It's not back up to pre-pandemic levels, but it definitely is rebounding and moving back up after the pandemic. And the one alarming statistic, even before the pandemic, was a dramatic increase in vaping nicotine and vaping marijuana. Among the teenage population, it had been surging for 3 years.
Oh, yes. We know we have several. I'm sure every city does. We have several vape shops, and the flavors weren't regular and menthol. They were bubble gum. They were grape. Yeah. They were orange, cherry.
Yeah.
And they were at least advertising it as the safer alternative to smoking.
And that's how a lot of adolescents look at it too, unfortunately. And that's why we're seeing the tremendous increase in teenagers using vaping as a method to get their nicotine. What they fail to recognize, though, is that they're getting higher concentrations of nicotine through vaping, which makes it much more addictive than smoking tobacco. With tobacco, you get a lot of carcinogens, but with vaping, you get pure nicotine, which has its different set of effects on people.
Yeah, that's become its own epidemic. I don't think that when they started vaping, they would have imagined that our young people would come out. And because really, I mean, smoking is still around, but I remember when doctors preferred Camels and there was smoking on every TV show.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that kind of all quelled down just as vaping started getting really huge, and it caught on like wildfire.
Yes, it has. And among the teenage population prior to the pandemic, for 3 years, it had been surging. So it was becoming very popular with teenagers and still is.
Now, how do you see them when they come home? Do they form those trust bonds back after, you know, a lot of times there's been years and years of this?
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of that is worked through family therapy sessions where those issues of trust, boundaries, responsibilities are all worked out in family therapy sessions with the advantage of having a therapist there that can guide the discussion. Because really, communication styles need to change, boundaries need to be set up, and all of those ideally can be worked out in family therapy sessions with the guidance of a therapist who can guide the family, and the individual who's returning to the family can guide them towards discussions that will lay the foundation for these issues to be addressed before the person returns home. You want to address them before the person leaves to come back home.
Now, what would you say to a family that is experiencing substance abuse with their child? Maybe they have been to wilderness treatment before, they've been to a regular medical detoxification or treatment center. What are the steps that those families need to take?
Well, what I recommend in my book is if you suspect your child is using a substance, it's important to get a comprehensive assessment. You don't want to just focus on the alcohol or the drugs. That's important. You do need an addictions assessment to isolate and identify the extent of their substance use. But you also need a comprehensive assessment, a psychological assessment to rule in or rule out if the child is dealing with any underlying mental health issues that need to be addressed as well. So you need really a comprehensive assessment. The other thing I would say is that there are all kinds of treatment options available for families, everything from outpatient to inpatient to residential. And that's the importance of getting a professional treatment plan put together from professionals who can tell you not only what the diagnosis is, but what is the best treatment option for your child? Is it an outpatient program? Is it an intensive outpatient program? Or is it a residential program? And if it is a residential program, what residential programs will be best for your child? Every child is different. Every treatment plan is different. But it all gets back to a fundamental issue of having a comprehensive assessment and diagnosis.
Yeah, because I think that what we see is families are really shocked by the extent of the use and the ability of their children to hide it from them.
And I think that does surprise them, you know, because kids are very clever. They know how to conceal this. But it gets back to the issue that I was talking about earlier and the reason I wrote my book. Parents don't know, because no one told them, about the warning signs, what to look for. It's like anything else. If you know what the warning signs are, let's say a medical disease, you know what the warning signs are, you're more likely to catch it and intervene earlier. The same is true for substance abuse. Many of these parents were caught off guard because no one told them what the warning signs were. No one told them what to look for. Had they known what to look for, chances are they might have caught their child using a substance much earlier and been able to intervene. But unfortunately, because they didn't know the warning signs, they didn't catch on until this had become a crisis. And you're right, kids are clever. They know how to fly under the radar. They're able to mask and keep this information away from their parents until truly it does become a crisis. And that causes parents to panic, and then they have to work within a crisis environment.
Right. That's kind of like we talk about what we do is triage.
Yes.
And I'm someone who doesn't come from an addictive background, but that I was ill since I was born with a divided pancreas, and then it manifested into some really, I was critically ill for quite a number of my adult years. And when I noticed the triage, how they triage in a medical situation is almost exactly how you triage in a mental health situation. You know, you need to accept your diagnosis and prioritize action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. Be brave enough to start over and over until you're making some progress, and then create that stellar support system for yourself starting with the higher power, but definitely both. I think it's important and almost vital that the child and the families have their own support groups and also support groups that they have in common.
I agree. I think a support system, both while you're going through treatment and after treatment, is a key component to recovery. The other thing that I would say to families is, so many times, part of this disease of addiction is it unfortunately involves relapsing. We will face relapses. People will face relapses. And my message to families is, we don't want to look, I encourage them not to look at a relapse as a failure. I would prefer that they look at a relapse as a learning opportunity. Because if you can look back and identify what led to the relapse, what caused the relapse, then you can learn from it. And the more you learn from it, the less likely another relapse will happen. So I try to encourage people to not look at an individual's relapse as a failure, either a failure of treatment or a failure of them as an individual, and instead look at it as a learning opportunity. We can learn from a relapse that will allow us to become stronger and that will reduce the likelihood that the next relapse will happen.
Yes, I totally agree. And it's not a requirement, certainly, for recovery, but it is a reality.
Yes.
And more often than not, the reality. Absolutely.
And I think families early on need to be aware of that, because they need to understand that there is a likelihood that their family member may have a relapse. We hope it doesn't happen, but it may happen. That's just reality. But if it does happen, how they approach it can make a big difference. If they approach it that the person has failed, that will lead to one set of outcomes. If they look at it as a learning opportunity, that will lead to another one. And just as importantly, if they can help their family member, who may very well feel like a failure as well, if they can help that family member look at the relapse as a learning opportunity, because many times they will look at it as a failure themselves. I relapsed, you know, and they will start to tear themselves apart. And if the family can help them switch that attitude, switch that way of looking at it away from being a failure to a learning opportunity, that person will become stronger.
I agree. So we're almost out of time. This has been absolutely fascinating, but I wanted to see if you could go back those couple of three decades and talk to a younger Richard about this career that you're embarking on. What would have helped you better to equip the families, equip the children? What would you have done differently, or what would you say to your younger self?
I don't think I would have done anything differently. You know, I spent three decades in education, which helped me to grow and to learn and to deal with different situations. I'm blessed that I was led into working at a crisis center, where I met many adults who were struggling with mental health issues, and I gained an appreciation of their struggle, which then led me to become more educated in substance abuse. And that led me to work at Menninger Clinic, where I came in contact with many adults, many teenagers, and many family members. So I don't think that there's any part of this journey that I would change, because it all came together to lead me to be able to have the blessing of doing the work that I've been able to do with teenagers and adults and their families.
Great. We're going to put your contact information and all of your links and all of that in the show notes. But quickly tell our listeners, what's the easiest or what's the most convenient way to get in contact with you?
I would say go to the book's website, which is www.helptheaddictedchild.com. HelpTheAddictedChild.com. There you can read about the book. You can read endorsements and reviews. You can read a sample chapter of the book. If you would like to purchase it for yourself or a family, there's a link that will take you to Amazon. It's available as a Kindle and as a paperback. It's not very expensive, but you might find some value in reading it to learn the warning signs, the treatment options, the assessments that I recommend, and keep it on your bookshelf, or perhaps loan it to another family that you think might benefit from it.
Wow. This has just been really great, Richard. You're a wealth of knowledge, and I can't wait to have you back on the show.
Anytime. It's been my pleasure, and I'd be more than happy to come back to continue our discussion at another time. Just feel free to reach out to me, and we'll go from there. But thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Of course. And we will see everybody on the next Recovery Comes Home Radio.
Thank you for tuning in to Recovery Comes Home Radio. We hope that today's episode has provided you with valuable information and insights on the recovery process. Remember, you are not alone on this journey. Keep seeking support, practicing self-care, and moving forward one step at a time. Until next time, stay strong, stay resilient, and stay humble. Hope lives here.